Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history, and I'm your host, Karen Peter. Today's episode is a collaboration with Community of Christ Historic Sites as we interview the presenters from the 2020 Historic Sites Summer Lecture Series. And these lectures can be found at the Historic Sites website, historicsitesfoundation.org, and we'll put that in the notes on the Project Zion website. Our guest today is Andrew Bolton. Andrew is an author, a former college and high school teacher, and an activist. He has served Community of Christ in many capacities, including coordinating peace and justice ministries for the church worldwide. He taught in the Community of Christ Seminary, and he served in the Council of 12 Apostles with responsibility for Asia and Indigenous peoples from 2007 to 2016. Now retired from church employment, Andrew has returned to England with his wife, Jewel, and currently serves on the World Church Peace and Justice team, and he serves on the European Peace team. The European Peace team is currently hosting the European Peace Colloquy, a series of webinars, each illustrating a dimension of Christ's peace. And for more information on that, you can email Andrew at abolton2@live.com, and we'll try to include that in the notes online as well. For more information, you can email Andrew at abolton2@live.com. President Steve Veazey will be speaking Sunday, September 27th, 2020. That will be recorded, and you can find it at peaceprojects.eu. Andrew's essays have been published in the Journal of Mormon History, Dialogue, as well as Restoration Studies in the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. With two others, he's completing an online resource called Four Approaches to Violence for Family Camps, Retreats, and Church Schools. The authors will also teach it as a series of webinars in February and March of 2021. Andrew has also written a second book on the Sermon on the Mount, Learn on the Mountain, Serve in the Valleys. That is in process of publication, and we'll let our Project Zion listening group know when that comes out. So, with that said, welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Karen.
It's so good to have you here. I enjoyed your summer lecture series contribution, which for the Historic Sites series was titled, Who Was Right About World War I, Frederick M. Smith or F. Henry Edwards? Now, for our Community of Christ listeners, both of those names are familiar. To our listeners who come from other traditions, not so familiar. So as we begin, can you say a little bit more about these two individuals to kind of introduce them to our listeners?
Yes, certainly. So Frederick M. Smith became prophet president of Community of Christ in 1915. He's the only president of the church that we've had with a PhD, which was spectacular, I think, in 1915. He was 40 when World War I broke out in Europe in 1914. He was the son of Joseph Smith III, grandson of Joseph Smith Jr. He was really into Zion and connected also with the contemporary social gospel movement. And he didn't mind quoting socialists like Karl Marx. He taught to everyone according to their need, from everyone according to their ability, for instance. Another of his sayings was, luxury was wrong unless it was commonly enjoyed. So his words about economic justice sound as radical as his grandfather's. He was also, though, an American nationalist. And when the United States joined World War I on April the 6th, 1917, also Good Friday, he supported the draft. He was opposed to pacifism and would not allow it to be preached from the pulpit. He referred to pacifists as cowardly slackers, and I get the feeling he was just totally disgusted by them. He was prophet president during both World War I and World War II, and he didn't change his views in World War II. And in fact, he was a colonel in the Missouri National Guard in World War II. So you get the picture. F. Henry Edwards was British, became 17 the day Great Britain and its empire entered the war on the 4th of August, 1914. He was training as an accountant. His parents were working class and Welsh and had moved from North Wales to Birmingham, England, looking for work. They were first of all LDS and then they joined the reorganization. And you have a sense that they were a strong and devoted church family. Conscription, or the draft, was introduced for the first time in British history in January 1916. So it was an innovation. So it caused a stir. Edwards refused to be drafted. To be a CO was a legal right, but the hearings were very biased against COs. They had a member of the army on board whose job it was to make sure no one was approved as a CO. And Edwards, not surprisingly, was refused CO status. His appeal also failed, and he was arrested at home in December 1916, was court-martialed, and sent for 112 days hard labor at the notorious Wormwood Scrubs prison in London. Whilst there, he was able to persuade a new tribunal, the Central Tribunal, that in fact he was an authentic CO. He chose the option of doing civilian work of national importance and was sent with 1,000 other young COs to Dartmoor Prison, which was decommissioned and used as a work camp. If you've seen or heard the Sherlock Holmes story, Hound of the Baskervilles, that's the prison. Gloomy, misty, dark moors, haunting prison. And Edwards was there for 2 years. He had to do work of national importance, and for him, it was working in the kitchen. So you have Smith, president of the church, a US patriot with a PhD and age 40 at his prime. F. Henry Edwards was a British working class teenager, a trainee accountant, a priest, and a pacifist. And the question I was posing, I'm posing, is who was right about World War I?
Thank you for that introduction to both individuals. So a lot of our readers may be more familiar with World War II in American culture, at least. It has been the subject of multiple films and television series and has received a romantic kind of aura about it from cinema and from television. We are less familiar with World War I. So can you just give us a brief overview of it? You put it in context in your lecture, and I want to point people to that lecture so they can see not only the wonderful photographs that you provide, but to hear your lecture in complete detail, which is marvelous. But we do need some context about World War I.
So by researching F. Henry Edwards, then I began to understand World War I. So I read These Worlds by John Keegan, a World War I historian. He wrote, these are his first words of the book. The First World War was a tragic and unnecessary conflict. It was a local conflict that did not need to go global. It could have been solved locally. European empires were in conflict. There'd been an arms race between Germany and Britain. And it was the first mechanized, chemicalized, industrialized war that resulted in 8.5 million military deaths, 6 to 13 million civilian deaths, and over 50 million deaths from Spanish flu. So it was terrible from that point of view. Michael Kazin, another historian, this time an American historian at Georgetown, said, Historians both left and right now see the First World War as a terrible and tragic mistake. So there's a unity about assessing World War I from the historians. So why was it tragic? Well, the Bolshevik Revolution would not have happened in 1917. It ended empires. The Austrian-Hungarian Empire was over after the war. It redrew the maps of the Middle East, which still have consequences today. World War II followed, caused by World War I, the unjust peace of the Versailles Treaty. That meant Holocaust, the atom bomb, and the Cold War followed World War II. And 9/11 is a consequence of World War I. So we do well to understand World War I. And Matthew Naylor, who's the president and CEO of the National World War I Museum in Kansas City and a Commuter Christ member, has said this: World War I was the founding catastrophe of the 20th century. So let me repeat those ominous words. World War I was the founding catastrophe of the 20th century. And if we're to understand our century, we have to understand World War I.
Thank you for that context. For those listeners in the greater Kansas City area, that might be an excellent place to visit when the pandemic recedes enough that we return to some semblance of community life together. So with that bit of context about the climate of World War I and the catastrophic results of World War I, let's go back to F. Henry Edwards and his choice to register as a conscientious objector at this time. And if you could tell us a bit, it's not an easy path. What caused him to choose to do this?
So his conscience, and we'll come to the actual words that he used, his rationale. So there were 20,000 COs in Britain in World War I. In the United States, there was also resistance. A third of a million didn't register. Around 6,000 British COs were court-martialed, and F. Henry was one of them. We have his crime that led to him being court-martialed.
You show that on your lecture, correct?
Yeah.
That card,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And he was part of a movement of COs, but many others were also resisting the war. So many socialists were against the war. They had an international perspective, saw workers in other lands as brothers, comrades, struggling with capitalism like they were. And there were soldier poets like Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen, who in their poetry told the terrible truths of war. Sassoon was a soldier from the beginning of the war, August 1914. And he wrote a letter of protest to his commanding officer in July 1917. It included this line: "I have seen and endured the sufferings of the troops and can no longer be a party to prolong these sufferings for ends that I believe to be evil and unjust." His letter was published in the Times, the establishment newspaper, and read in Parliament. He was saved from being court-martialed by being sent to a mental asylum. And women were also part of the protest movement. Sir John Francis was a general in World War I, a British general, and he had a sister who campaigned against the war. So there will be some interesting conversations in that family. And so far, we've found 8 World War I Latter-day Saint conscientious objectors, 6 from the LDS tradition, one of whom was Canadian, 3 were British, older men married with children, 1 was from Utah, who was a British immigrant, so we could count him either way. And one was a German who got in the medical corps and lost a leg when a British grenade landed between him and his patient. So there were 2 RLDS conscientious objectors, F. Henry Edwards and a Missouri farmer married with children called Charles Dexter Brash. So we should celebrate him too. He had a 5th grade education. So of this group of 8 Latter-day Saint conscientious objectors, F. Henry's the youngest and the only one for whom we have a written account of his reason for being a CEO. Actually, Charles Dexter Brush just put down the name of the church. So tribunal records, the draft boards, in Britain were nearly all destroyed after World War I. And there were nearly 20,000 COs in Britain in World War I. So having those tribunal records would have been fascinating, but we don't have them. But Edwards wrote a letter to the Saints Herald, aged 17, written on the 12th of February, 1915, published May the 12th of the same year. And here's the relevant extract. "My fellow countrymen are making great sacrifices for their king and country, and I want to be willing to give my life, if need be, for my king, capital K, the King of Kings, and for the establishment of his kingdom, to be a patriot in the great sense." So what I marvel about this statement is he got the parallel between the King of Kings and King George V, I think it was, and he got the parallel between his country and Christ's universal kingdom. And he's only 17 when he puts this together. So it's amazing that he was so insightful and was able to articulate that.
What catches me in that quote from his letter to the Herald is how he used the word patriot. "I wish to be a patriot." It casts this interesting light in the current conversations that take place in the United States that confuse patriotism with nationalism and confuse patriotism with allegiance to a civic country, as opposed to he's using it, patriot, as his allegiance to God's peaceable reign, to God's kingdom. I think it informs our conversation in the United States greatly at this juncture.
Yes. And he's only 17. I remember when I was 17, I wouldn't have been able to articulate that. So it was also a fact that the church had just begun again in Germany, 1914. Think of the close relationships we share with one another in the church. It was unthinkable for him to accidentally kill a German church member. And there's a story in the British Isles that at one of the tribunals that he was asked if he was willing to serve on a minesweeper. Apparently he said yes, if he could clear British mines as well as German mines. So again, his universalism.
Yeah. When you introduced F. Henry, you talked a little bit about when he went before the tribunal, and he was sent to, is it Wormwood? Did I have that correct? Prison. He had quite a journey with that. So if you could tell us a little about that journey from Wormwood to then to the prison where he served with the other COs. And then you talk about something that is called the home office scheme, which I found an interesting aspect of his journey. So if you could kind of chronicle that for us, that would be helpful.
So Lloyd George, a Welshman, was Secretary of State for War and later Prime Minister. He said he wanted the path for COs to be a very hard one. Very hard ones, in quotes. So prison was hard labor. Cold in winter, hot in summer, insufficient food on purpose to weaken the resistance of COs. You were alone in your cell, no visits or letters for the first 2 months. There was a silence rule, so you couldn't talk when you were out on your exercise. And that has mental issues. And there's punishment. Field punishment number one was the worst, where you got arms tied to a post and you were leaning forward. It was very uncomfortable. The Frenchmen were a group of COs taken to France, about 40 of them, May or June 1916, and they were going to shoot them. One of them tossed a message out of the railway carriage onto a station platform, and it got to his family, who alerted their MP, and Quaker MPs then lobbied the Prime Minister and got it stopped. So people didn't know they were going to be executed or not. And the records show that 73 conscientious objectors died in prison. 31 COs went insane. So it's tough. the Home Office recognized that all these COs were being mistreated. I mean, there's questions asked in Parliament. We had the allies of Quaker MPs. Their deaths were happening and so on. So they developed the Home Office scheme, which was a work scheme that people could choose and do work of national importance and be out of the way, out of the public mind, but not so mistreated. So the Dartmoor prison, this notorious Hound of the Baskerville prison, was converted to a work camp. Locks were taken off the doors. Basically, the COs ran the prison, but they did 9 hours work a day.
So as you were describing his experience in prison and hard labor, much of what you're describing would now be considered torture by our current modern understanding of the treatment of prisoners of war or of conscripted individuals. So when we talk about prison and hard labor, we're talking about some very severe punishments that happen to individuals in that. So when you talk about this very difficult path, it is an extremely difficult path that he chose. Would he have known, would he have had any understanding that this was what was going to happen when he chose conscientious objecting?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, church family contemplating going to prison. I mean, it's outrageous, isn't it? Now, his parents supported him, so he's fortunate in that. But not all church members understood that, and perhaps we can talk about that later. So, yeah, it's a tough road. But I think in some ways CEOs appreciated that, because when that came out, they couldn't be accused of cowardice.
So let's contrast F. Henry's experience and his choice with the very nationalist perspective of F.M. Smith, Frederick Madison Smith. So you shared a little bit about what he felt about the war, but their perspectives were quite different. Can you tell us more about his experience and then what happened after the war with these two individuals?
So F.M. Smith was ordained president of the church in 1915. His dad died, Joseph III, around December 1914. And the last editorial written by his dad, Joseph III, supported U.S. President Wilson's stand of neutrality. And that was good, because we had American RLDS members who were of German heritage as well as British heritage. So this made for peace in our congregations. This all changed on the 6th of April. Ominous, isn't it? 6th of April, 1917.
Very much so.
And the Crucifixion Friday, when the U.S. joined the war. So F.M. Smith was not the only church leader who joined the patriotic bandwagon. Catholic bishops, Protestants supported the war, urged the young men to obey the draft, be drafted, be conscripted. And you had the terrible reality of Catholics killing Catholics and Protestants killing Protestants in France. So F.M. Smith, as I've said, would not let pacifism be taught from the pulpit, thought they were cowards and slackers, and he didn't change his views in World War I and World War II. But there's also a peace side to him. Zion was about holistic peace and justice, and he was really into that. His dad, Joseph III, in a Doctrine and Covenants section, spoke of apostles of peace in 1913. And F.M. Smith in 1920 also had a section added to the Doctrine and Covenants with this apostle of peace idea. Also, F.M. Smith popularized the church seal beginning in the 1920s. Before that, it was invented in 1874. It was just used for legal documents. But now in the 1920s, it began to be used on stationery, letterheads, and church publications. So the lion and the lamb led by a child with a garland of laurel leaves and the word peace at the bottom began to be seen more widely in the church. So he moves us in a peace direction, unwillingly, but he does that. I think he's responding from an awareness that World War I was not everything he believed it to be at the time. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and it quite evidently didn't become that.
In fact, it became the opposite as it begat World War II.
Yes, the Russian Revolution, and so on.
So here we have these two individuals, F.M. Smith, as you described him, who was an interesting character in his own right, as you delve into his life a little bit in other contexts. He was a very interesting individual. The picture of him, American nationalist, well-educated, privileged in very many senses of the word. And F. Henry Edwards, so very different. So their experiences during the war were quite different. What happened afterwards? F. Henry Edwards spent his time in two prisons and then comes home to community afterwards. What was that like?
So I think it's helpful to understand F. Henry Edwards' commitment to going to church. So, for instance, he was allowed out from Dartmoor Prison to go to a congregation in Exeter. The whole trip took at least 5 hours, the round trip, and it was mostly uphill on the way back.
A five-hour trip to go to church from the work camp where you're already exhausted and staying in a prison atmosphere.
Yeah.
That's commitment.
So, yeah, he was committed to church. And
so all of us who don't want to get up early on Sunday morning to log in online hear this quite well. Yeah.
Yes. And the local branch bought him the bicycle. So there was difficulties though in his home congregation in Birmingham. And we live in a city not far from Birmingham. And I was researching F. Henry Edwards some years ago, and I was talking with Ida Dix, a dear elderly sister, about this. And then she said, oh, there was trouble in the Birmingham branch. So what happened was when the Edwards family came into the church, into the congregational building, some would sing, God is marshalling his army, and add the line, we'll have no cowards in our ranks. So it was very difficult for a while. Some would walk out when he stood to preach. In the end, though, he won most. He lost his trainee accountant position because he was a CO, but he ended up working for the church. So British church leaders recognized his abilities as a minister. So he worked through these, but it was tough for a while.
Going home after that experience would be difficult for most, but to go home to your church community, different than your home community, but your church community, and have that kind of division would be really difficult to get over. It's admirable that he then begins working for the church and exhibits such a love for the church throughout his life. So let's talk about that. He does begin working for the RLDS Church. How did that happen for this young man?
So he was really good at detail. He was good at keeping records, so he kept statistics of church membership. And if you look at the volumes of church history, the statistics about the membership of the church at different periods. So he's done the statistics. I mean, he was training as an accountant. He probably learned shorthand in the prison because it was a class offered. So he was more educated than a number of people in some practical skills. And he was very diligent, very capable. So we've talked about F.M. Smith and F. Henry Edwards having very different views. Then they actually meet in 1920. So the British Isles is an important historic mission of the church. And F.M. Smith has been delayed in coming to this after his ordination in 1915. So in 1920, he came on a long missionary tour after World War I, and he needed a secretary. So F. Henry was asked to be the secretary. So this is pregnant with possibilities, isn't it? So this is actually what happened in their first meeting, in the words of F. Henry. I went to F. M. Smith's room the first time in fear and trembling, but soon found that he was kindness personified. When I settled in a little, I even ventured a question or two. For me, it was like a course in church administration. So kindness personified. And F.M. Smith became a mentor F. Henry Edwards had had a good relationship with his dad. They talked about church teachings and history and so on. And he fell into that kind of relationship with F. M. Smith. And so that was a very positive and surprising outcome from their encounter.
Very surprising. It's one of the marvelous aspects of the story, this meeting that you describe in your lecture, of this young man who spent his time during World War I in prison and work camp, and this very educated president of the church with his American nationalistic tendencies. It's like a movie waiting to happen in that scene. So during your lecture, you show this marvelous photo in which we see President Smith, F.M. Smith, and F. Henry Edwards, and Smith's daughter, Alice. So share a little bit why that's significant.
Well, there's a story just before that, so as background. So F. M. Smith, in 1922, called F. Henry Edwards into the Council of 12. He was just 25. He's the youngest ever called in the Council of 12 in the Community of Christ. This illustrates it's possible in the Community of Christ to have very different perspectives on some issues, but still have a very loving, trusting, productive, working relationship.
So, Andrew, I'm gonna stop there and ask you to re-clarify so that our listeners don't miss the importance of this. With everything that F. Henry Edwards experienced and everything that F. M. Smith said about conscientious objectors and his position during both wars, he calls F. Henry
into the Council of 12.
Yes.
Age 25.
This is a momentous happening considering their experiences during World War I.
So they illustrate you can have faithful disagreement and still get on together. They model unity and diversity. So, yeah, it's wonderful. So I want to say that Smith's trust in Edwards was justified. He served in the Council of 12 for 24 years. Then he was called into the first presidency by Israel A. Smith in 1946, and later by W. Wallace Smith in 1958. So he served in the first presidency 20 years. So it's a total of 44 years in church leadership. That's a long time. And he was a very good, efficient administrator. He's also been called Articulator for the Church. That's the title of Paul Edwards' book about him. Paul Edwards is the son of F. Henry and a scholar historian. So Edwards, in his preaching and in his writing, voiced the message of the church. And according to Keith Wilson, a BYU professor at Provo, Edwards wrote more than any other church leader, either in Community of Christ or the LDS Church. So he got up at 3 or 4 in the morning to write, then did a full day's administrative work. Yeah, F. Henry was also a good pastor. So he remembered people's names really well. So for instance, he knew my wife, Jewel, and always greeted Jewel by name when he met her as a child and as a teenager. So the other wrinkle in this story is F. Henry Edwards marries F. M. Smith's daughter, Alice. They had two sons, both of whom are still alive. They lost a child and they adopted a child. And they were married over 50 years.
So when we see the picture with other individuals, with F. M. Smith and his daughter Alice and F. Henry, we see this complete coming around of this story from these divergent paths to not only sharing the leadership of the church, but in their family experience. And Paul Edwards has some wonderful tales to tell about his mother, Alice, F. M., and F. Henry. And he's a delight to listen to. During the lecture, you shared a little bit about F. Henry's role as articulator of the church, and you talked about his contribution of introducing the concept of grace into the church. Can you share a little bit more about this? This was new information for me. and maybe for our listeners.
So in some ways, F. Henry is the creator of Community of Christ, but he does it very skillfully. It's not obvious, but he helps various currents go in that direction. So that's another big topic. But so he introduces grace into the church. Actually, grace is central to the teaching of the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. Remember, Paul experienced grace. He held the coats of those who stoned Stephen. He persecuted the church, and then he was met by Jesus on the road to Damascus and was converted. So Paul, coming into the early Christian church, experienced grace. It wasn't theoretical, it was experiential. St. Augustine, four centuries later, also emphasized God's loving, saving grace. And it was reclaimed by Protestant reformer Martin Luther. And the letter of James talks about both faith and works. The Latter-day Saints quote James about this, but they tended to emphasize works, the transformation of life being worthy in the LDS tradition. And so sometimes we Latter-day Saints forgot about grace. But the truth is, we can't be good in our own strength. We love God because God first loved us, to quote 1 John. It's love that releases the power to love in us. Grace releases the power to be gracious to others. And F. Henry Edwards is in touch with British Christianity. He reads Anglican theologians. He doesn't quote them. He doesn't name his quotations. He doesn't cite them. Which was okay in those days. And if you're preaching, you don't need to cite. But he's in touch with grace. And Anglican theologians can be very helpful. Now I want to tell a story. So it's around 1955, 1956. F. Henry Edwards is a member of the First Presidency invited to go to Australia. And one of his duties on that trip was to open the new church building at Drummoyne in Sydney. There's a plaque as you walk in the door saying, opened by F. Henry Edwards. And Jeff Spencer, who later worked for the church, a very important theologian in his own right, was a student sitting his final exams. And he was struggling, do I go to church and listen to F. Henry Edwards, who I may never hear again? Or do I pass my exams? So he compromised. He took his books to revise at the back of church during the service. F. Henry stood up to preach, and he preached on grace. Jeff was transfixed, put his books to one side and listened. And it was a life-changing experience for Jeffrey Spencer. And Jeff went on to magnify the gospel of grace in his own ministry. So I want to say gospel means good news. And without grace, there is no good news. There's no gospel. So no grace, no gospel. Grace is the good news. And so I'm very grateful that F. Henry Edwards helped us come to a balance by reemphasizing the importance of grace. That's right there in the beginning of the New Testament church.
And we see that in our own enduring principles currently when we talk about grace and generosity. And grace runs through Community of Christ, those currents that you talk about, F. Henry, introducing. They run through Community of Christ.
And it's the first enduring principle.
Grace.
Yeah.
Marvelous. So, Andrew, I know that your areas of study are broad, and we've had many conversations about that. But how has your study into Community of Christ history, specifically, let's talk about this concept of what F. Henry Edwards contributed to the church. How has this study contributed to the shaping and forming of your own discipleship?
So I came into the church and I heard these stories about F. Henry Edwards. My big regret is I never interviewed him. There was one opportunity to do it and I didn't do it. So here we have a working class British teenager who was very courageous. That's an inspiration for me. And the path of faithfulness to Jesus is sometimes lonely, sometimes hard. He was willing to endure shame, ridicule, the disapproval of others in taking his stand. So I'm inspired by his courage. The Central Tribunal had a lord and a sir interviewing him. So aristocrats, educated, speaking pompously in a very alienating tone, working class young man. And he stood up to them with courage. So Edwards is an inspiration to me of courageous discipleship. And his story is important for the church now as we consider nonviolence at the 2022 World Conference, as we think about Jesus' commandment to love our enemies. F. Henry's story is important for our day too.
For our Project Zion listeners, what are some aspects of this story of relationship between F. Henry and F. M. Smith that might inform us in our discipleship as we move forward together as community?
So they vigorously disagreed about war. And I have good friends who vigorously disagree with me about violence and war and the gospel's teaching. F. M. Smith was a U.S. nationalist. F. Henry Edwards was a conscientious objector. However, their relationships were kind, warm, and respectful. And that happens in the church. F. Henry was called to be an apostle at the age of 25. F. M. Smith allowed his daughter, beloved daughter Alice, to marry F. Henry. So F. M. Smith and F. Henry model faithful disagreement, unity and diversity. And as Community of Christ begins a major discussion on nonviolence at the June 2020 World Conference, F. M. Smith and F. Henry Edwards model how we can stay together, work together, love each other whilst disagreeing.
You give us a picture of our best selves. So we're going to bring our episode to a close, Andrew, and it has been a wonderful chatting with you about this. And again, I want to point our listeners to historicsites.org to see Andrew's lecture in full, complete with photographs and other aspects of the story. But before we come to a close, do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to share with our audience?
So to be a conscientious objector is more than being a conscientious objector against war. To be a conscientious objector is the essence of being a disciple. We're called to be conscientious objectors against poverty, against racism, against Islamophobia, against anti-Semitism, against sexism, against abuse of the earth. So conscientious objector is our calling as disciples. And to hear the voice of Jesus and follow him means one must be a conscientious objector to many things as they exist now, as we pursue a kingdom life on earth as it is in heaven. And unless we have the courage to live out the worth of every person and the sacredness of creation, we're not following Jesus. So conscientious faithfulness to Jesus means conscientious objection to many things in a fallen world. We can learn from the conscientious objectors of World War I and subsequently. They were called in World War I the stormtroopers of resistance against that war.
Thank you, Andrew, for that and for being with us today.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.